In our book, The Good and Beautiful God, James Brian Smith quotes Dallas Willard saying, "The process of spiritual formation in Christ is one of progressively replacing destructive images and ideas with the images and ideas that filled the mind of Jesus himself. Spiritual formation in Christ moves towards a total interchange of our ideas and images for his." If there was one image that I had of God without even really realizing it as I grew up, it might just be that of Scrooge McDuck. Now, if you were a kid anywhere near the 90s, you know the cartoon DuckTales and that famous theme song that it had that went, "DuckTales, woo-hoo." Now, I know I just got that stuck in your head, and I'm not sorry, because it's an awesome song. But the idea behind DuckTales was that Huey, Dewey, and Louie have somehow gotten themselves in trouble, and so their uncle Donald can no longer take care of them for some reason. And so instead, they're shipped off to this other uncle that they have that's elusive and kind of a crackpot and things. And when they arrive, instead of meeting their uncle Donald, they meet this helper of his, this woman who basically is there to tell him not to touch anything, not to get in any trouble, and never under any circumstances to bother their Uncle Scrooge. So let me set the scene for what this parallel is and why it matters. When the kids finally do meet Uncle Scrooge, they meet this man, or in this case, an anthropomorphized duck, who is obsessed with one thing, money. What's the most iconic image from DuckTales? What do you think of when you think of Scrooge McDuck? It's that moment where he's standing on top of a diving board in this like 1950s era bathing suit in this ivory tower that's hundreds of stories tall, and it's filled completely from top to bottom with gold coins. And then you see Scrooge do this triple gainer into the coins, and where he should splat, instead he goes into it like it's water, and he swims around and comes up and spits a stream of coins out of his mouth. I'm pretty sure I remember at least one episode as a kid where Scrooge McDuck dropped a coin and chased it down through a crowd of people, pushing old ladies out of the way and like using his cane to smack kids. That's how obsessed Scrooge McDuck is. It's been said that Bill Gates, and therefore by extension Jeff Bezos, if he were to drop a $100 bill on the ground, mathematically it would not be worth his time to bend over and pick it up. But with Scrooge McDuck, he's so obsessed with pinching pennies and his coins that he would bowl through a crowd of people just to get that one extra penny in his coffers. This iconic image really speaks to something that is deep within what I believed. I didn't want to believe it. I didn't think about the fact that I believed it, but it was a parallel nonetheless. You see, if I had to characterize one fictitious image of what I might believe about God, I would say that I was believing in Scrooge McGod. You see, just like what Huey, Dewey, and Louie experienced, sometimes I had this idea in my head that God cared about me, but only the bare minimum. He really cared more about his things. And while I'm down here struggling, he's swimming in this universe-sized pool of all the riches of the earth, just carefree. That image is perfect for the character. In my uncritical, non-reflective way, I saw God as unreasonably rich, but incredibly distant. I saw him as this person who didn't care enough to even come and talk with me himself, but instead would send this stern, morally reprehensible person who was disinterested, and their primary job was to lay down the rules and to make sure that I didn't get in trouble. Are you catching this? Wow. Are you seeing these parallels? I'm willing to bet that if you took a moment to think that there is some fictional character that really describes pretty well what you believe about God, whether you want to admit it or not. I'll give you a second, and then I want to take a moment in the comments section to talk about that. So while you're thinking, let me just clarify that I would never have said this explicitly. I would never say, oh, I believe in this Scrooge McGod. That's what I really see him as. I had some half-memorized Bible verses and some studies that I had under my belt, even at a young age, to where I could tell you all the things that you were supposed to hear. But deep down inside of me, this is kind of what I believed, what I felt. So let's take a moment in the comments section. What is one fictional character that you see as a parallel to what you believe about God? When you engage in the comments section, you help move this from a monologue to a dialogue and a conversation. You help to help others dig into the concepts and wrestle with what's being said. So one more time in the comments section, what fictional character might describe your hidden or deeper views of God? Now, I don't want you to be alarmed that you might be believing in a God that you didn't even realize was there. But the truth is, our deepest thoughts often go uncritically reflected upon. And we create these caricatures that don't describe what we would say we believe, but what we actually and truly hold to. And as we started this series, we noted that the narratives that we believe about God are the most important thing about us. They're the foundation that we build our mental houses on. They're the lens through which we see all the rest of life. And so these conversations are important. They're ones that will make a big difference in our lives. Because think about how different my life, his favor, and pay for his attention. What kind of a God does that create in my life? In his masterpiece, The Good and Beautiful God, James Bryan Smith puts it this way. This narrative goes like this. Love and forgiveness are commodities that are exchanged for performance. God's love, acceptance, and forgiveness must be merited by right living. What God most wants for us is for us to not sin and instead do good. And this narrative is rooted, as all false narratives are, in half-truth. True, God does not want us to sin, and God does want us to do well, but that is only because sin harms us, and acts of goodness are healing both to us and to the recipients of our goodness. The all-seeing, all-knowing God is aware of every bad thing we have ever thought or done, and if so, guilt, fear, shame, and the hunger for acceptance become the primary motivators in our performance-based culture. That's hard to hear, isn't it? And yet, it does ring some bells. If that's what we believe about God, then of course God is stingy and miserly. Of course God only cares about our performance. But as we've been going through this series, what we're focusing on is the God that Jesus knows, the God that Jesus wants to tell us about, and the God that Jesus knows and wants us to fall in love with is unreasonably generous. He is unreasonably generous. But if we're going to uncover that God, we need to take a look at the stories that Jesus told, the stories that he wanted to use to help us shape this narrative of who this God is. So turn in your Bibles, if you will, to Matthew chapter 20. If you don't have a Bible that you allow to go through you on a regular basis, I would encourage you to pick up the Bible app on your favorite device or your tablet or phone. In that app, it has so many helpful resources. It can even read the Bible to you while you're driving in your car or while you're listening in your headphones in a language, a translation that makes sense in your life and your heart. If you'd like a hard copy of the Bible because that works better for you, just reach out to us. We'd be glad to give you one for free. So take a moment, turn to Matthew chapter 20. We're going to start in verse 1. It says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the workers on one denarius, basically one day's worth of pay, he sent them into his vineyard for the day. When he went out about 9 in the morning, he saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He said to them, "You also go into my vineyard, and I'll give you whatever is right." So off they went. About noon and about 3, he went out again and did the same thing. Then about 5, he went out and found others standing around and said to them, "Why have you been standing here all day doing nothing?" "Because no one hired us," they said to him. "You also go into my vineyard," he told them. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard told his foreman, "Call the workers and give them their pay, starting with the last and ending with the first." When those who were hired about 5 came, they each received 1 denarius. So when the first ones came, they assumed that they would get more, but they also received 1 denarius each. When they received it, they began to complain to the landowner. "These last men put in 1 hour, and you made them equal to us who bore the burden of the day's work and the burning heat?" He replied to one of them, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Didn't you agree with me on 1 denarius? Take what is yours and go. I want to give this last man the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with what is mine? Are you jealous?" Listen to these words. "Are you jealous because I'm generous?" There's a lot to unpack here. We're not going to see everything there is to see in a 25-minute message. And so I always encourage you to start a Jesus conversation. Get together with a few friends or family members and just talk about some questions. If you go to our website on the groups page, there's a button right there up front that says Impact Guide. If you click on that, you can download a great resource that will help you walk through and have some of this conversation with others. Because it's one thing to say, you know, our key thought, that God, the God that Jesus knows, is unreasonably generous. But it's another thing to work through those deep-seated narratives that we have in our lives. It's another thing to wrestle with what we really believe down deep under all of the baggage, under all of the things that we say we believe. The story that Jesus is telling here is shocking. I mean, really shocking. But the problem is, we have looked back on it with 2,000 years of familiarity, and we've just become comfortable with these words. They lose the impact of what they originally had. But the way that Jesus told them, the things that he said in this, the people there would have been having this reaction. The same reaction this guy had when Brock Lesnar broke The Undertaker's undefeated streak at WrestleMania. Now, you don't need to be a wrestling fan to feel what's going on in this image, do you? You can just inherently understand that this guy is experiencing shock, maybe even trauma. And that shock is exactly what people experienced as they heard Jesus share this narrative. So let's talk about that. So the first thing is, the setting of the story wasn't what shocked people. In fact, it was incredibly commonplace for that day. The area around Jerusalem had about 18,000 people, by some estimates, who would be out of a job. So what does that look like for the world around them? Well, historical surveys are a little mixed. Roman historian Tacitus estimates around 600,000 people might have been in that whole region of Jerusalem at the time of the Jewish Wars. Hillel Geva, on the other hand, states that there were only about 20,000 people in all of Jerusalem around 70 AD, which would be about the time, a little after when Jesus would have said these things. And the Biblical Archaeology Review believes that there were about 80,000 people in the city. So if we harmonize those things and just come up with a number around 100,000, 18,000 people being out of work and being itinerant day laborers would be roughly about the same percentage as what we experienced in the Great Depression. Pretty close even to what we're experiencing right now in our country. This is an important story to set the context for, because we want to understand where it is that Jesus is using common things that would make people feel comfortable, and where Jesus was invoking that image of shock to help them loosen from the deeper seated understandings that they weren't even ready to wrestle with yet. Because the reality is, the landowner in Jesus' story would have seemed like the hero. Right? He's the guy who not only does he go out early in the morning and get those who are ready to work, but he keeps coming back. 9 o'clock, noon, 3 o'clock, even up to 5 o'clock, where there's only an hour worth of usable daylight to work. He keeps pursuing these people, and he keeps inviting them into this bounty, this land that has lots of work to be done. So if this is the first story that you ever heard about God, what would you come away with? How would this start to put a new image in your perspective? Given the imagery of the landowner who seeks people out who don't even deserve it, who maybe are still sitting around at 5 o'clock because they're lazy, this paints the picture of a generous God. A generous God. But here's the problem that those who were first hired had. You see, they expected more. In fact, they had been living in this narrative of earning favor. And ironically, biblical scholar Joachim Jeremias notes that this parable that Jesus told was actually very similar to another parable or story that rabbis would use commonly in this day. He notes that in the popular telling, the owner of the vineyard explains that this last group got the same amount of money as the first ones because the first ones were lazy, and the last group actually worked harder. In other words, the landowner was actually pulling something shady. He was trying to get more free labor out of them unduly. He was Scrooge McDuck, pushing people out of the way so that he could chase after just one more coin. But Jesus' story is the opposite. It has nothing to do with earning. It has nothing to do with justice or fairness. It has something else at the point. Jeremias concludes, in the parable of Jesus, the workers who were engaged last show nothing to warrant a claim to a full day's wages. That they received it is entirely due to the goodness of their employer. Thus, in this apparently trivial detail lies the difference between two worlds, the world of merit and the world of grace, the law contrasted with the gospel. You see, the God that Jesus knows is unreasonably generous. Here's another chance to respond. Maybe you've had a little bit more time to think and reflect, and if you haven't, that's okay. You can always come back to this video later and add your thoughts into the comment section to keep the conversation going. But in the rabbinic telling, things make sense to our world. In Jesus' telling, they were shocking. So if this were the only story you had ever been told about God, what kind of God would you start to believe in? How would this story shape your thinking about God if you could, for just a moment, put aside everything else you've ever known and instead only heard this one tale Jesus was telling? In the rabbinic tale, again, things make sense to our world. It's all about earning. It's about those who work getting paid their due wages. And the landowner is Scrooge McDuck, who's just out to try and make a buck and build his fences bigger and expand his gardens and all of that labor, all of the work. He's just basically trying to cheat people out of it. In the rabbinic telling, the first people on the job got screwed. They got screwed out of money that they should have earned. And instead, this selfish jerk is finding ways around the system to oppress them. Doesn't sound familiar to anything in today's life, right? But the reality is, in Jesus' telling, we are forced to confront a generous God. Brennan Manning has said it this way: Jesus reveals a God who does not demand, but who gives, who does not oppress, but who raises up, who does not wound, but who heals, who does not condemn, but who forgives. Can I share a little secret with you? I still sometimes have a scarcity mindset. I still sometimes see God as Scrooge McGod, who's out there trying to build up all of his coffers, all of his vast amounts, and while I'm sitting here just trying to struggle to make it day to day sometimes, I'm ready to give up that story. I know intellectually that that's not the case, but it's hard. These ideas have been woven down deep into the fabric of how I understand life. See, I grew up in a world where for certain people, abundance was everywhere. Your Bill Gates, your Jeff Bezos make millions of dollars per day. And yet my mom had to work 5 jobs at one time just to put food on the table, just to make sure we didn't go without. I grew up in a world where if you wanted to achieve something in school, you had to be the brightest, you had to study the hardest, you had to be the one who worked. I grew up in a world where if you wanted to be, you know, dating a bunch of people, you had to be the best looking. And I was never the best looking. I wasn't the one who was the brightest. I wasn't the one who worked the hardest. And so I often felt left out. I felt like that guy, or again, anthropomorphic animal duck thing that Scrooge McDuck would just push out of the way because there was something shiny rolling ahead of him that he just wanted to get a hold of. When I look to God, my mind tells me he's generous, but the stories I was told growing up, the stories this world has tried to weave into the fabric of reality are very different. They're very hurtful, and they're ones that I actively have to work to unwind, because the God that Jesus knows is unreasonably generous. I keep using that word, and you've heard me say it before, but it's one that I use on purpose because it helps me to destroy this pattern that I've had before of seeing God as one who's got a scarcity mindset or who's always pinching pennies. You see, God is unreasonably generous. He's generous with his love, even when we don't deserve it, even when we actively spit in his face. He's generous with his forgiveness, even when we look him in the face and then turn the other direction and actively betray him. He is generous with grace. Grace is getting those things that we don't deserve. It means that I haven't earned it, I haven't worked for it, but because of God's nature, because he is giving and loving, it's mine. He's also generous with mercy. Mercy, similar to grace, but instead of it being me getting something I didn't deserve, it's us getting things or not getting things that we do deserve, like wrath and punishment. See, that word is meant to catch me off guard. It's meant to shake things up inside of me. When I realize and when I say those words that God is unreasonably generous, I'm reminding myself of the story that God is telling, of the God that Jesus wants us to know. See, God isn't Scrooge McGod, and I need to stop treating him that way. He's not running through crowds and pushing people over just so he can get something that he wants that I'm in the way of. The reality is, God is self-sacrificing. He cares about you and about me. He is always doing everything he can for his children. As Smith notes in The Good and Beautiful God, we have never been and will never be in a place where we can turn to God and say, "You owe me. I deserve this." We do not deserve anything we've been given. We have earned nothing. Yet God is not interested in what we can do for God. God is interested in something so much more important than our good works. God cares about us. He cares about you. My earthly father chose drugs over me. My employers chose quotas and deadlines over seeing me as a person. But God, He pursues us. In the morning, He goes out and sees if we're ready. He comes back at 9 a.m. and at noon and at 3 and at 5, right up until the very end of the day. He is constantly pursuing us. We have never walked so far away from God that He isn't right behind us when we turn around, ready to embrace us with open arms. And He is still pursuing you. He is still chasing after you, because the reality is, if I'm going to continue that word picture of Scrooge McDuck, you're that gold coin. You're that thing, that beloved, precious treasure that God has, that He's pursuing, that He's chasing after. He is ignoring all of the treasures of the world, all the things that He owns, because He wants a relationship with us. As Julian of Norwich has said, the greatest honor we can give to God is to live gladly because of the knowledge of His love. I need to hear that. I need to be reminded of that. God's generosity isn't just in what He has for us, but who He is towards us. God is an unreasonably generous God, and we are His treasure. As we continue in worship, I want us to spend some time in reflection. And so before we go back into the musical aspect of worship, would you join me in a moment of hearing Psalm 23?